Today, protests and fights in the courts, the election that divided America.
Democracy is sometimes messy. It sometimes requires a little patience as well.
But that yesterday, as votes continued to be counted across key states, most of them in Joe Biden's favor, he made a speech appealing to the American public to stay calm.
Senator and I, we continue to feel very good about where things stand. We have no doubt that when the count is finished, Senator Harris and I will be declared the winners. So I ask everyone to stay calm. All the people to stay calm. The process is working.
As we record on Thursday evening, he stands tantalizingly close to the presidency.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
But just a few hours later, Donald Trump gave this response.
2020 election. If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count the votes that came in late, we're looking at them very strongly, but a lot of votes came in late. I've already decisively won many.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, will Donald Trump accept the election result? Jonathan Friedland, you're a Guardian columnist, and like you, I've been glued to the rolling coverage of the US election for the past couple of days. I've probably developed quite an unhealthy obsession with CNN. It's been a very tense time for America. Let's go back to that moment where we realised this wasn't going to be decided on the night. Donald Trump came out fighting with that extraordinary speech in the White House.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
What was going through your head when you watched that?
You know, in a way, my first reaction was insufficiently shocked, I realise. I've become so inured to Donald Trump and his willingness to trample on really basic democratic norms, that in a way I sort of just banked it and clocked it as yet another Trumpism.
So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop.
It took me a moment, a minute or two, actually to digest that he had gone even further than he had ever done before, that it was even more shocking.
It's a very sad moment. To me, this is a very sad moment. And we will win this, and we, as far as I'm concerned, we already have won it.
Because what he was deliberately setting out to do was to undermine the public's trust in their own democratic process. And you realise in a democracy, that is all we have.
It is incredible, isn't it? And that has been the tone from him and his team over the past few days. As we record this on Thursday evening, results are still being counted. Why are they taking so long?
Well, American elections can take a long time, partly because there isn't a single federal system. Instead, it's this patchwork quilt of systems all across 50 states. But even within the states, it's down to local county officials. They all do their own thing. So there's huge diversity there. But the other factor is indirectly the coronavirus. Because of the prescription against gathering and for social distancing, and because of the fear of getting ill, millions and millions of voters this time preferred to vote by post, by mail. And that is why this has been more delayed. A state like Pennsylvania isn't used to postal ballots. This is a novelty for them. They didn't have the kind of equipment and infrastructure set up for it. And then in that state and also in Wisconsin, Democratic officials who saw coronavirus coming, Democratic Party officials, were saying, we've got to count these either in advance or start at 7 a.m. on election day. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to give a result on election night. Republican lawmakers, Republican legislators in the legislatures of those individual states said no. They didn't want that. And that's partly, it's believed, I don't think this is a conspiracy theory, I think they deliberately wanted this to go on long because they believed that the on-the-day vote by people who were not bothered enough by coronavirus to stay away from a polling station, therefore people more likely to be sympathetic to President Trump, they'll vote on election day. And it means by election night, it will look as if Donald Trump has won Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, the so-called red mirage. It will look like a win and therefore will only count the Biden votes, likely to be by mail, afterwards. So it was quite deliberate, this delay, and it was meant to create a perception that Donald Trump had won the election. And it's only really, in a way, by the vigilance of partly the media. You know, you've mentioned your unhealthy CNN addiction. It is the likes of the media who've been constantly saying to their audiences, this is normal. It's going to take some time. We don't know yet.
And it takes the time it takes because you want no mistakes. As long as they have powder, we'll keep going. As long as they can powder our faces. But here's what we know.
That has prevented there being what would otherwise have happened, which is some kind of rush to come to a verdict and to believe because the in-person votes said pointed to Trump, therefore the election was over.
It's amazing, isn't it, really, that in an election where over 100 million people have voted, it's once again come down to a small number of counties with a few thousand votes holding the balance of this election.
I mean, look, partly we should say this. It's partly because of their electoral college system. If this was about just who gets the most votes, which is how elections in most places are constructed, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We'd be saying the consensus has formed by a healthy margin that Joe Biden is the choice for president because he, one thing is unambiguous, he has beaten Donald Trump in the popular vote by millions, and we don't yet know how many millions, but by millions. Instead, in the end, in those immediate hours and days after polls closed, all eyes were on Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Nevada. All the eyes just go down to a handful of states, these battleground states, because they're the places that aren't firmly red or firmly blue, but are instead up for grabs.
Not every vote has been counted yet, but whatever Trump disputes, Biden has won the popular vote, like you said. What are the big trends we can pull out from this? Let's start with the Democratic vote. Who did Biden manage to persuade?
Well, Joe Biden's vote was always going to be anchored. The absolute foundation was going to be African-American voters. They are always the most loyal to the Democratic Party by a mile. And you can, and he has, ratcheted up huge percentages of 75, 80%. The issue then was always going to be about turnout. And one of the things that's really interesting in some of those closely fought states is that the Biden vote, often by post, came in often from areas that where it was guaranteed to have a large African-American population. You saw that, for example, in those last stages of the Georgia count. Otherwise, we're talking about cities. So, for example, in the count in a state like Pennsylvania, all eyes immediately go to Philadelphia or to Pittsburgh. In Michigan, it was about Detroit or Dearborn. And then beyond there, it's the immediate suburbs. And this was always going to be crucial for Joe Biden. It was where Democrats surged in 2018. The so-called blue wave happened in those suburbs around the big cities. And people really link that very heavily with another big demographic part of the story is the gender gap. So it's the suburban women who voted in unexpectedly high numbers for Donald Trump in 2016. You know, even if Hillary Clinton was able to win over a lot of them, she wasn't able to win them by as much of a margin as she needed to. And once again, it's early days, but it seems as if that is again where Joe Biden was successful. It's good. One reason why I'm slightly qualifying is just because the exit poll that normally is the source of all this demographic data, there have been some questions asked about how reliable it is. And so I think, you know, I'm wary of just immediately taking as read what the exit poll is saying. But the final building block, I think, in the Biden coalition was among white men and also white women who were not college educated. That was a demographic Donald Trump was always going to win. But what Joe Biden appears to have been able to do is to eat into that advantage a bit, just a bit, in those key upper Midwest states. So it's a coalition, people of color, it's people with college educations, it's suburban women, and it's closing the gap among a sort of white male rural demographic that definitely goes for Trump, but just a make them go for Trump a little less.
I think a lot of people might have an idea of who they think the average Trump voter is. But what has this election told us about who supports him?
Well, I think it has been an eye-opener because the people got their heads around the idea that there was a Donald Trump base, and the caricature was white, was male, was rural, often either literally working the land or in one of those post-industrial towns. Donald Trump has just done much better in terms of millions of votes than that demographic alone would carry you. He's obviously won over other people. That includes your old style, and we must never forget these people, your old style traditional Republican voter, affluent, suburban themselves, who have not abandoned voting Republican because of Donald Trump. But I think the big revelation has been that he made inroads in areas among groups that previously were seen as being just assumed to be anti-Trump and pro-Democrat. And that the one group I've got particularly in my mind is the group that we perhaps no longer will call Hispanic voters. And I say perhaps no longer because I think a lesson of this election is that there is no such thing as a single monolithic Hispanic voting bloc, that actually different communities vote different ways. But Donald Trump made real substantial inroads with them. I think the estimates are, you know, as many as a third, 36% is a figure I saw, of Hispanic voters backing him and potentially making the difference in particular areas. So why did Donald Trump win Florida? The numbers were not great for him everywhere, but he suddenly did really well in Miami-Dade County. Now, that county, the area around Miami and its environs, did go for Joe Biden, but it went for Biden much less than it did for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Why? Because some of those Latino voters, Cubans, Venezuelans, and others, went for Donald Trump. It was in some ways a stereotype that people just thought this president, Donald Trump, who has been really so insulting to, say, Mexican immigrants in his very first announcement for running for president back in 2015, surely all Hispanic voters would feel slighted and offended and would be repelled by Donald Trump. No, it does not seem that way.
Even before this election, Trump was already saying that this process was open to fraud and he cast doubt on the postal vote. How are he and his team challenging the results now?
Well, they are lawyering up. They have filed lawsuits in Georgia, in Michigan, in Nevada, in Pennsylvania, armies of lawyers.
You have, like in the state of Michigan, you have 138,000 votes that magically appear that are all 100% Biden votes.
And submitting lawsuits on every possible ground, claiming irregularities, claiming that ballots were accepted with, you know, dodgy signatures, claiming that the guidance, the advice to voters was somehow improper.
Even if they voted on November 3rd in Pennsylvania because they were told that that was okay to do, you're going to toss their ballot out if it doesn't come in until the day after or 2 days after.
No, we believe every vote on election day should be counted, but it's those that arrive after the election day that we are fighting in court.
Even if they already voted on November 3rd, which is the postmark.
There's a whole bundle of things. There is also just the more traditional claim, which is for a recount. Under Wisconsin law, the loser in a race, if the margin is 1%, can ask for a recount. So you can fight a battle like this on 1,000 legal fronts, and they are doing that and hoping that, as Donald Trump said in that speech we talked about, that he will take his case to the Supreme Court. I mean, as it happens, it doesn't work like that in American law. You can't just march into the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court only hears cases after they've worked their way through a sequence of courts and come up to them as the ultimate arbiter. But Donald Trump appeared not to know that and to think you can just barge in there. And he thought, I'm sure, well, look, I've given three of these people their jobs on the court. They're bound to rule for me. Let's get this sorted.
Right. So these challenges then are probably not going to work.
I've been reading around and just hearing from the lawyers who are specialists in this field. And it is interesting to hear how sceptical they are. We know that the court is very nervous about getting involved in elections. They don't like it because they believe it politicizes the court and compromises its own standing of impartiality. They will only do it if it is an absolute last resort. They did that in 2000 because it all came down to Florida. That the question of whether or not and how and for how long votes could be recounted in Florida would decide who would become president. Donald Trump doesn't have that kind of clarity at the moment because there are so many different states in play. There are a few other points as well, I think, which make it, you know, never certain, but unlikely for Donald Trump to prevail in court. One of them is that the Florida case I've been mentioning was all about a recount. It was about whether or not votes that had already been counted could be and should be recounted. Here, Donald Trump is asking the Supreme Court to stop votes being counted for the first time. And in a democracy, it is very hard to make that argument. I would be skeptical that Trump has a path, but, you know, he is a man who bends things to his will. And so you would never want to count him out.
What impact are Trump's statements having on the American public?
Well, I think it's, you know, as always, we can't talk about a single American public because his base have obviously been stirred by it. And that we've seen those protests outside the count, people chanting, stop the count. The tune of Lock Her Up. Slightly awkwardly, also Trump supporters can be seen in Arizona saying, to the same tune, count the vote. Right? Because they think in Arizona counting votes helps Trump, and in Pennsylvania they think stopping helps Trump. This too, by the way, is a damaging situation for his legal case because a federal court, like the Supreme Court, will take into account the inconsistency of the Trump legal team. And they will say, they will notice and say, we notice that in other courts you've been saying stop and here you're saying start counting. We think this goes to sort of opportunism in your case. It suggests a kind of inconsistency. That kind of reasoning is allowed in a federal court. And so there are lawyers who've been saying that Trump has ruined his own case even before it started by the sheer inconsistency of the arguments and the fact that they are so obviously self-serving. Meanwhile, though, to answer your question, the base has picked it up. Of course they have. They're all finding conspiracy theories. I noticed in one state they were tweeting pictures of what appeared to be a mystery ballot box arriving in the dead of night. It later turned out to be a camera operator with his equipment, and he was just taking out his, you know, camera and lights out of his own TV van, and it wasn't a ballot box at all. This is how, you know, ready many Trump supporters are to believe the worst. I think noticeable is the fact that Trump's call has not been picked up or echoed by the Republican congressional leadership, by even, I think, Fox News. They're sort of waiting. They're not going yet hard on this. He's slightly on his own.
Yeah, the people batting for Trump are his family, aren't they? His closest associates. I mean, his son, Eric Trump, and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. But, you know, on the other side of this, is Biden challenging any of these results?
He hasn't done so yet. They've got lots of lawyers. They're ready to defend. But I think a big part of the political case is that we accept that the people have spoken. We want the democratic process to run its course. We are grateful to state officials for running a smooth election. I think it would be very much against the sort of tenor politically of the case they're making to the country for them to do that.
Power can't be taken or asserted. It flows from the people. And it's their will that determines who will be the president of the United States, and their will alone.
So I think they'll defend vigorously. But right now, as they believe, as we, you and I talk now, that things are more or less heading their way, they haven't seen reason to do that.
I'm not here to declare that we've won, but I am here to report when the count is finished, we believe we will be the winners.
Trump may not have enjoyed a resounding victory at this election, but he has, as you say, increased the number of votes this time around, which just shows that his winning in 2016 wasn't a one-off or a fluke. Millions of Americans feel that he represents them, or at least haven't been put off by the way he's governed, have they?
No, I think that's right. I think people did kid themselves that 2016 was a fluke. You know, maybe it was Russian interference. Maybe it was because Hillary was such a polarizing figure. Maybe it was that notorious James Comey letter saying the FBI was reopening its file on Hillary's emails. No, I don't think those things work now. Because one belief that people took comfort from was, well, people voted for Trump surely thinking he would change and he would moderate. Maybe that held up as a reason in 2016. Nobody can say that in 2020. They knew who he was. They knew what they were getting. And enough people liked it. I think that has to, you know, trigger some kind of reckoning in America. But it does. It means there's no hiding now, no excuses. Millions and millions of Americans love Donald Trump or like him enough to vote for him.
Where does this leave the Republican Party? Will they only continue to be electable if they pursue a Trumpian agenda?
This result leaves the Republican Party in a place where they're almost on hold. They are now frozen as the party of Trump. He amassed so many votes, 68 million votes, with an absolutely hardcore, undiluted Trumpian message, America first, a kind of nationalist message, that it doesn't allow any other Republican voice really to emerge. This may be true practically as well. Trump may just simply not leave the stage. And therefore, he's this huge, you know, oak in whose shade nothing else can grow. So there's no possibility really for new leadership to emerge. And so if Trump had been, you know, on the receiving end of an absolutely crushing defeat, that could have prompted a real rethink by Republicans, where they would say, look, we can't do this anymore. We've got to sing a different tune. Instead, they have to continue doing what he's been doing, because their own base will expect nothing less. The base has shown that, and bigger than just the base, you know, half the country nearly have shown that they are up for Trumpism, and therefore a Republican Party that seeks to even inch away from it, very difficult.
Part of the Democrats' campaign message attacked Trump as a racist and a sexist, but half the electorate has voted for him. How should they interpret this result?
Well, Democrats are interesting. So there's all this introspection, and there's obviously the left saying that Joe Biden, too centrist, too bland, too moderate, and if we'd had a fire-breathing radical, we'd have done better. Obviously, people and moderates in the party saying that's absolutely not true. We only did as well as we did because Joe Biden was there, and he was a kind of frictionless magnet to other voters, because, in other words, there was nothing to put you off. If you were thinking of voting against Trump, there was no reason, no friction that would prevent you voting for Joe Biden. So that argument is going to be thrashed out. I think it does, in a way, depend on the shape of the final result, the final tally. If just enough states go Joe Biden's way that he can claim actually to have done pretty well, better than anyone thought on election night, I think you'll hear less of that argument. If it really is just a squeaker, then I think you will hear more of it. You know, that comes with the territory for the Democratic Party, but I think it's also to do with unrealistic expectations. There was such hope that this was going to be an absolute watershed event in which Donald Trump was expelled from the White House, Mitch McConnell was expelled from the Senate, at least as majority leader, and a blue wave would take the White House, take all of Congress and Capitol Hill, and suddenly a new program that would be able to do wonderful things on the climate crisis and on inequality and on racial justice and remake the country. That didn't happen and hasn't happened, and therefore there is a sense of tremendous disappointment.
Coming up, what does this election mean for the future of democracy in America? Biden and Trump's very different visions have split the electorate in half. This is a country, Jonathan, that you know well. What do you think this tells us about America today?
I think this election confirms something which people had tried to wish away, but is stubbornly true, which is that the country's not just divided in the sense of can't agree politically, but is almost two nations, this 50-50 nation, this red America, blue America. These two nations within the United States see almost everything differently. so that even a matter of public health and science, like the coronavirus, has become so intensely political that you, whether you wear a mask or don't wear a mask, tells you about which part of the country you're from. But it's now about two different kind of closed systems where the two get their information from completely different sources. There's a Fox News America and an MSNBC America, crudely. And where even, as I say, things that previously were seen as outside politics, the realm of fact, is now contaminated by a very kind of tribal political allegiance, to the point where it becomes a question, really, how governable is the United States? How united is the United States? Or is it actually, you know, creaking now, this attempt to hold these two very different cultural systems, nations, under one roof?
Is there a danger that millions of Americans will lose faith in democracy after this election?
I think that's a real danger. And I think that's what Donald Trump was doing when he said, you can't trust this election. If Joe Biden emerges as the man chosen, I think there could be 40-45% of the country who just don't accept him as the legitimate president. This has been brewing for a long time, by the way. When I was in the United States in Washington during the Bill Clinton presidency, there were people all the time who said he was illegitimate, but they were on the fringes. They were quite marginal, but they were there. There were more of them in the Barack Obama period, who again believed, you know, he's not born in America. He's not false, obviously, but, you know, he's, and therefore didn't accept him as legitimate. I think that percentage is growing and growing, who therefore will believe this was stolen from them because their leader, Donald Trump, has told them so. If you believe that, what is that going to be like for 4 years? If this man who you believe is stolen his seat in the Oval Office, you know, if he has to send people into harm's way, if he has to announce tough measures against coronavirus, who will accept that if they don't believe it was legitimate? The most important element in a democracy is loser's consent, the consent of the loser. I tweeted earlier today, video footage of George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush the elder, conceding defeat in 1992. And at the time, I was there for that election. It seemed like a completely banal, routine, boilerplate moment.
We see it, and the country should see it, that the people have spoken, and we respect the majesty of the democratic system.
Listen to it now, in which George Bush talks about the majesty of the democratic process and wishing his successor, his opponent, the best of luck. It is quite moving to hear that now.
That our entire administration will work closely with his team to ensure the smooth transition of power. There is important work to be done, and America must always come first. So we will
get behind
this
new president. Realize how far the country's come from that, and yet without it, without that consent of the loser, democracy cannot function. And when I say that, I'm not in any way suggesting Donald Trump should have conceded already or conceded when he spoke at 2 a.m. Washington time. Far from it. You only do that once the votes are counted. But what you don't do is go in and say, you can't believe this, you can't trust it, it's a fraud. It undermines people's faith in the process. And the one thing no one will tell you will happen is if all the votes are counted and it shows clearly that Joe Biden's the winner, nobody is holding their breath for a gracious concession speech from Donald Trump.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Friedland. Read his election analysis at theguardian.com, where you can also listen to him on the Guardian Politics Weekly podcast. The episode today takes a look at the races for the House and Senate and what these might mean for the next few years of American politics. Keep up to date with all the latest on the election and the aftermath at The Guardian's 24-hour US live blog from our brilliant team working across the states. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Thanks for listening this week. Have a lovely weekend and we will be back with you on Monday.